Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Mysterious calls, mysterious meetings, and mysterious meets. Are you in a filter bubble? Week starts in September, but the 4 days of trading end strong and listener questions. All this and much more on episode number 627 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. I am your host of this podcast, co-host of DH Unplugged, where myself and John C. Dvorak spend time together each and every week on Tuesdays and have a good time doing so. But this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where we also talk about finance and money and topics that are important to you. And we're going to hit some of those today. Just as a quick update, yes, the hurricane did kind of come over this way into South Florida. It was spooky, really just incredible amount of apprehension, concern, nervousness, right up until the point where it made that turn north. And it waited until the very last minute to get going. So we were prepared. We had to lock down the house, lock down the backyard, make sure everything was good in terms of the amount of supplies that we had, waters, of course. And fortunately, while it was a lot of work doing that, the preparation wasn't really needed. But, you know, at the same time, like we talked about last week, you got to make sure that preparation is done. You got to make sure that you have it in the bag just in case. And we do the same thing with our portfolios, of course, and prepare for the worst and hope for the best on a regular basis. And that means just being mentally ready, having a plan. We talked all about this last week. So if you haven't listened to episode number 626 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, make sure to take a listen to that and check out what's going on there. So we have some listener questions. We have some things to talk about today. I'm going to talk about this whole idea of a filter bubble, something that I recently heard about. But before we do so, let's kind of do a quick recap on the week. Because it was a shortened holiday trading session. We only had 4 days as Monday was Labor Day. And it started out pretty bad with the notion that, you know, these tariffs that everybody was hoping for would be kind of put aside. The idea that President Trump is going to increase, China is going to increase, but maybe last minute, 11th hour, something's going to happen here. Maybe there'll be a postponement. But that didn't happen. So the additional tariffs were put onto a variety of goods, and many products that had not been tariffed or taxed before were now added, and many of those included consumer-related products. And as such, we saw the beginning of the week come down pretty strong on Tuesday when markets reopened, and there was a big concern and no relief over the fact that, yes, these tariffs are going to go on, and retailers got hit pretty hard. Industrials, we saw the continuation of many of the names in the steel industry and all sorts of metals, aside from precious metals, but, you know, construction goods, et cetera, really get hit pretty hard. And then, of course, we saw the miraculous, hey, I got a call from China, or China got a call from Trump, or the new, well, there's a meeting planned for October. That lifted the spirits of the markets, and all of a sudden, the idea that there was some renewed desire to open up the trade talks again came out, and markets were just on their way higher with the idea that the Fed was going to be backstopping whatever was going to go on. 25 basis points already baked in the cake for the September, I think it's the September 18th meeting. So we look at all this and realize that the headline-driven market action continues. Not going to go away for a long period of time. By the end of the week, the S&P 500 was up 1.8% about, and the Dow Jones, I think, was up about 1.5%. NASDAQ up 2.2%. And once again, the small caps lagged. But what was interesting to notice, and I saw this at the end of the week as I was doing my end of week research, was that the big winner this week was value. Generally, you could split the markets into two halves, or not halves, I would say two parts. You have value and you have growth. Growth being those companies that expectations for the future, opportunity for earnings growth and revenue growth are very high. Less stable companies potentially, but oftentimes you see those really get a bid when investor enthusiasm is pretty high. And value, the other side, is your higher dividend paying, your more stable companies, the financials, the staples. Growth is technology, healthcare, consumer discretionary. Now, when you look at this and put it all together, you have to look at the longer-term pattern of what's gone on. The differential between growth and value has been extraordinary. There has been a very clear winner in growth, more so than we've seen in a decade, where the preference to invest in tech and healthcare has been much greater than in, let's say, utilities or staples, or real estate to some degree. Income-producing, income-generating, stable companies, the banks. And I've been looking at this for a long time thinking, you know, this is probably going to be a reversionary trade because we saw this. We've seen this situation play out many times over the years. In particular, back in the late 90s into 2000, there was a clear move to value in the beginning. Everybody rushed into value. That started petering out. Growth picked up and everybody rushed back into growth. And of course, both sides of it, any of the late players into either of those sectors really got hurt. But we really haven't seen a spread of the difference in returns like we're seeing today. Again, the preference of the last several years has been overwhelmingly in the growth area. And those have been performing, not only from a stock price basis, but also fundamentally. The good news is that many of these companies continue to earn significant money, and the growth of their revenues, the growth of their earnings, their overall business has been really accelerating dramatically. And therefore, investors are much more inclined to go to that direction because the returns are there, the opportunity is there, where it wasn't so much for the value side. And when you look at small caps, in particular, the small cap value versus small cap growth, very wide range. So you could do something like if you have either Excel or you have some charting package, when you look at just simply putting on the returns of the value, whether it's the Russell 1000, the large cap value versus the Russell large cap growth, or the small cap version of either, put that on a chart and look at the difference in returns over the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, it really is incredible. And you have to believe when you look back in history, there's going to be either one of two things that happen. Either value will catch up and grow much more dramatically and be bid up for whatever the reason as growth stabilizes for some time, or growth will come down dramatically and value will hold its value potentially on a relative basis. Of course, this is all a relative trade. So we've been leaning more and more towards value as we have the opportunity to do so. Our portfolios are tilted more towards value. So a little bit of underperformance from that area this year. But I do believe that it's a much, I would say, safer. That's a weird word to use, but it's a much more appropriate way to balance a portfolio considering all that we know now. All that we know about what's happening around the world in terms of the geopolitical tensions, the slowdown in overall GDP around the world. It just seems like while there has been this preference, if people still want to be invested in equities, and there is an entire grouping, whether it's institutional, individual, that is required or needs to be in equities. And the question then becomes, what side do they want to be in? So we're taking the belief that, well, if you want to be in equities, it might as well be in the plays that have a better dividend, a stronger balance sheets, that have less potential volatility historically. And those advisors and analysts and portfolio managers, money managers, hedge fund managers that have a belief in the value side have a very hardcore belief in value over time pays off significantly. Not wanting to pay up the high levels of PE and PEG ratios for a growth stock would rather, and they'd rather be in value. And they'll pound the desk hard on that. Now, the growth side of it will pound the desk for their particular way of investing. But if you look at the long-term history, there is some logic in the idea of playing on the value side of things for the long haul, particularly in times when there's volatility. Now, again, we're in a little bit of a weird situation here because rates are starting to come down. Around the world, rates are either negative or super low. Crisis level interest rates, even though there's been some, obviously some benefit of all of this, and there's been a pickup since the crisis. We're back below, I mean, think about Europe. Europe is below crisis level interest rates right now from the central bank, the ECB. We're not there yet. But even Alan Greenspan last week, who didn't look so good on TV, if you watch his interview, he looked a little like he's getting a little there, up there in the years. But nonetheless, he is even saying it's only a matter of time until negative interest rates come here to the U.S. I find that hard to believe. It would seem that, number one, that it would take a major debacle here to push us into that level. And number two, if anybody's watching how this has played out in Japan and Europe, they would know that it does absolutely nothing to benefit the core tenets of what the Fed is looking to do. It hasn't helped their employment, hasn't helped their inflation. All it's done is weaken their currency and allowed for further money to be pushed into the markets, helping the wealth effect. I just can't imagine that is a tool that would be used. But we'll put that on the burner in the back and see what happens later on, because we are obviously on the path towards that. So this reversionary trade, this idea of value versus growth, I think is something to consider and watch, keep on your radar. Put the small cap ETF on your radar, add the value, add the growth, put the large cap ETF, IWM, for example, I mean, small cap is IWM, put the large cap on there as well, on the Russell 1000 ETF, pick one that you like to look at, and then look for the value and the growth ETF as well. Put them all on a chart or put them all on some kind of a watch list just to see what happens over time. Check on it weekly. See if there's a trend developing and if there is going to be this reversionary trade, because if it does in fact happen, we do think it will be very substantial, benefiting value over growth. And with all the things that are going on around the world, it's very interesting to see how this week was such an incredible differential. I mean, we're talking about 2% on the small cap value on the upside. Small cap growth was flat to slightly up last week. That's a big difference. So is it happening now? Again, we thought this was going to happen for the last year and a half, and it hasn't. No harm, no foul, because you still have some growth in the portfolio, just leaning towards value. But when it becomes a reality, and if it does, it could be pretty dramatic. Something to think about. I was listening to a TED Talks on a podcast, doing some exercise and listening to a variety of different podcasts. And I was listening to the TED Talks daily, and a phrase came into the discussion. It was a phrase I really hadn't heard before. Something that I don't think I heard before. At least if I did hear it, I didn't listen to it. So there you go. But it was called, it was a filter bubble. filter bubble. What do you think about that concept of what those words mean? I started to think about this, and I was like, you know, it seems to me that we've talked about something like this before. We talked about this concept of a confirmation bias. And how is this different from a confirmation bias? And I was thinking about this. Because you always want to make sure that when you're doing your research and your work and you're taking all the analysis from everywhere that's available, that you're not going to be overlaying your own biases on it necessarily in order to make the data and information look the way you want it to be. You don't want to remold it just so it's believable by your particular areas that you have these beliefs in. That doesn't work when it comes to investing. I mean, I'll give you an example. If you have a bias to be only long and buy stocks, you think it's going to be a bull market, regardless of the information that's being presented, no matter what you're going to do is you're going to buy the dip, right? Okay, fine. That's been working out. That's great. But if you start to see some information that comes through and you're like, well, yeah, it's not that good. However, on the other hand, maybe it means this. I don't believe it. Anybody that says it's going to be a stock market sell-off, you discount. The news comes in from companies. They say, hey, the next 12 months isn't going to be that good. You discount it. You know what? They're just sandbagging. So confirmation bias can be a very powerful thing that really helps to change our concepts of what's happening. Let's just start with a definition so you really understand what I'm talking about here. And when it comes to confirmation, the best definition that I found was this tendency to interpret new evidence as confirmation of one's existing beliefs or theories. You got that? So what we're trying to do here, or what happens when we have this confirmation bias, is that any evidence that comes in, we try to reshape in the form of how it fits into our own personal narrative, how it fits into our beliefs and thought process. So when we absorb things and hear things, we redefine it in a way that essentially makes our current belief set more believable. We're correct. Yeah, I was right about that. That guy's wrong. No, he's seeing it this way. It really meant to be that way. So oftentimes we watch television and we may agree with the thesis or the news or only pay attention to those that we agree with. We follow those people on Twitter that have similar belief sets. Anybody that's saying something negative about Apple, we're not going to follow them. Because you know what? We believe that's all they ever do. They're always negative on Apple since they said something negative about Apple. And I love Apple, and therefore I'm not going to follow them. I'm just going to only follow the people that are lovers of Apple, the company and the stock, and the products for that matter. Anything else that comes into play, they just pick it on them. They say something negative about a product. What do they know? Apple will fix it. That's just their own thing. They like Android products. They're just negative Nellies when it comes to this. This is how our mind works. It's very difficult to get out of that because it's uncomfortable. It doesn't fit. So confirmation bias can be a really powerful idea molding process that oftentimes could, or possibly, not oftentimes, possibly, can get us into trouble. We don't want that happening. We want to stay neutral on the information and just utilize what we see, what we know, and use the facts, if there is such a thing, to make a good decision. If we look at the charts, and you look at a chart and you're like, wow, that stock is doing really well, but I hate the stock. There's no way I'm buying it. Why do you hate the stock? I don't know. I just don't like it. You know, look at Chipotle as a great example where Chipotle, for a long time, people said, I'm not going to that place. My God, there's all this potential for problems and sickness and they're dirty and they need to clean up. They're never going to be able to do this. Stock dropped. Oh, yeah. Look at that. Stock is dropping. I knew it because this is a terrible company. Stock gets a little bit of a base going on there. Company comes out with a turnaround plan. They come out with new management. All sorts of new announcements. Stock starts riding up. But that person who hated Chipotle is like, I'm not going there. That company is doomed. They're going to have another problem. Look at all the problems they had already. There's no way I'm going to buy that stock. Meanwhile, what you missed out on is an enormous move in the last several months to an all-time high with analyst estimates going up and up and up. So be careful of confirmation bias. But again, I wanted to really look into that when we start talking about this whole idea of the next point. But confirmation bias, the big issue there is we have a choice of what we watch and who we believe, and for that matter, what we read. We have that choice. Now let's segue over to a filter bubble. Here's the definition of a filter bubble. A situation in which an internet user encounters only information and opinions that conform to and reinforce their own beliefs, caused by algorithms and personalized an individual's online experience. Caused by algorithms that personalize an individual's online experience. Now, there's a very interesting difference there between a filter bubble and a confirmation bias. It's subtle, but it's still there. And I think the difference is that when we're online, we're getting things pushed to us. Algorithms are essentially looking to provide us with our beliefs. They're looking to push back and shove data and stories and information at us. And the purpose of that is to not only mold us, but realign us and make sure that we stay with our current beliefs. Essentially, they're creating agreement without the need for confirmation bias. There's no alternatives being sent forward. There's no bias here at all. It's straight regurgitation of information that we have in our belief system already, and thereby essentially shields us, prevents us, or filters everything out. Other opinions, and dare say the facts, from entering into the conversation. And here's the interesting thing. You may say, well, how'd they do that? How are they... We gave them the power to do that. We're providing them the information through social media in particular. And this is where the problem really lies. Because now we have a logic that's programmed into this algorithm that can take who we spend time with, what we talk about, unfortunately, what we say on various calls through platforms that they're recording and keeping and shoving through their systems, the places that we shop. All of this is then fed into the machines, and then they come out with what is it that we would want to see in the form of better suggestions, right? Don't you ever see that, right? Do we want to make sure that our suggestions for search or you're matched up with what clothing you want to buy, or we want, so therefore the privacy issue is all about making sure that we get what we want to see. But there's a rub. The rub is they can actually now sell that data to be targeted back to us with all the information that we've provided. Think about how unbelievable this is. What a great idea. What a great, the advertisers are like, yeah, man, this is sweet. So we let these companies know all about our beliefs. They sell the information, and we then essentially get reprogrammed or enhanced programming Everything else is filtered. So with confirmation bias, we have a mental choice. We could take that information that we see that's entering into our brains and make a choice. And if we are going to discount everything, that's a choice that we make. With a filter bubble, on the other hand, the choice has been somewhat made for us. It's one-sided. It's designed to reinforce. Now, think about this when you're doing your research, when you're coming up with your theories, when you're looking at, you know, economic information, stocks, news, geopolitical issues. Think about all of this when you're going through this process and as you're making decisions. And think about whether this is an idea that you had, your belief, the research that you did, or is it someone who's programmed you to believe this is the case? We are in a bull market, therefore you must buy stocks. We are in a correction, therefore you must sell stocks. This stock is a great company because of this and that and this. Don't believe the other people. There's plenty of that going on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else. It's bad enough that you have people that are trying to push on their information on you. What's worse is that you have algorithms that are now taking the information, your likes, your desires, the people you spend time with, where you go, what you do, what you buy, what you eat, and pre-programming that to look at what your tendencies will be and then reinforcing those to a point that you believe that's the only way. And living within a filter bubble is a problem. Because when we get that filter bubble to the level that we just have no tolerance for any other information that comes in, not a good outcome. Free thought is out the window. So check that when you're looking at your Twitter feed and when you're looking at who you're following on Facebook, the ads that come up. Why is this? Close down your personal detail settings. Be careful what you share, unless you're okay with all this. Don't worry about it. Who cares? I get better shopping tips because I tell them where I'm shopping, what I'm doing, and all that. But think about that in the terms of investing, that you want to make sure that you understand all aspects of each side of the argument in order to make an informed decision. That's what we do before we make any decision. I'm going to talk about one in a minute, by the way. Before I make a decision on something, I want to understand all the different aspects and make sure my bias, what I am seeing, and maybe what I'm hearing from certain areas, is not necessarily the only way. What's on the other side? Should I believe it? Should I just let it go? But understand and be cognizant of when you are in either a filter bubble or when you have a confirmation bias situation that is building. At least with confirmation bias, you have a choice. The filter bubble pretty much knocked out everything else. So if you're getting your news from social media, maybe that's not the best thing to do. If you're looking at only one site and one side of the discussion versus another, maybe that's not the best thing to do. Maybe you should take in all the information and look at all the different angles of it and then make an investment decision because it's your money. You have to think about the other side at all times like we do all the time for our portfolios. What are we missing here? What is the information that we're getting that doesn't make sense? Why is it that I can't find this information on this particular topic? Seems a little fishy. Do your best to interpret the data appropriately and don't get yourself into a filter bubble. That's all I have to say. That's all I have to say about that. Segueing into the next area that I want to talk about, which deals with a little bit of a confirmation bias concept. You see, I was in the mall. I was meeting some friends for dinner. And on the way throughout the mall, my wife said she had to return something. So we went over to Williams-Sonoma, stock symbol WSM. I went to the store. No one was there. Well, there was a couple of people working there. But other than that, there was nobody there. And I was thinking, maybe this is a one-off situation. But I looked around. I looked at the prices. I looked at some of the things that I was looking at. I was looking at a, since we had a return, we could use the credit to buy something. So I was looking at a lemon squeezer, lemon juicer. It's a little lemon juicer. It's kind of heavy, but it was in good amount of metal involved in this. It was $24. I'm like, what in the world? That seems expensive. So I did a quick check. I found it in a lot of other places online at like $10, $12. So, okay. Looked around. That's an interesting sauce over there. I looked at it. It was like $18 for this little jar of sauce. These spices, a four-pack of spices, was $27. I said, you know what? These prices are insane. No wonder why there's nobody shopping here. Who in their right mind would shop there? I even asked the store clerk. I said, who shops here? And she told me that it's some bridal registries, but more importantly, it's people that really have no culinary experience or really don't know what they're doing. They just come in here because they know it's in the mall. They know it's a store that you could buy a variety of wares for your kitchen, for your house, and they just buy, regardless of the price. I said, oh, really? Interesting. So I started thinking, I actually posted this on Twitter. You can follow me at Andrew Horowitz, one word on Twitter, by the way. I started thinking about this, and I said, well, maybe there's a great short opportunity. Let's take a look at the stock. Stock was holding up pretty well. I saw on my phone. I came to the office to do some more research over the weekend just to kind of understand a little bit more about this, thinking this could be an interesting short play because if the economy turns down, the pricing that they have, and a few other things I was thinking about, this could be a really good situation for a short opportunity, especially in the retail space that's been all over the place of late. So now here I am thinking, yep, I wouldn't shop there. Who would shop there? And look at the store. It's empty. Yeah, I'm confirming my bias that nobody shops here because it's too expensive. And yeah, I'm only at one store, but okay. But I did some research on it. And I was looking at the price and comparing it to other stocks. I was looking at the fundamentals. And I saw that, for example, the comp sales were growing at low single digits. The company recently raised their estimates for fiscal year 2020. Stock on a chart seems to have really good support at 62. It's currently trading at about 65.25. So I started, is this a short candidate? Stock chart doesn't look like it. I saw there was about 10 days to cover short positions. In other words, if the average volume were utilized on a daily basis in order to cover the 17% of shares that are sold short against the company, there could be the potential for a significant short squeeze. So that's not great when it comes to shorting. Not the worst I've ever seen, but nonetheless, you know, you want to be careful about how much short interest is out there. Price to sales was 0.89, which is reasonable. Forward PE is 13.25 in the middle of the pack when I compared it to peers. Average analyst has a hold rating on the stock with a price average of 66 is right where it is now. Estimated forward growth is slowing somewhat. There was 18 earnings per share EPS revisions in the past 30 days. And those were all higher. So analysts are basically seeing a better future for this company. But I started thinking about, well, is that considering that we now have higher tariffs on some of the goods they're bringing in because of the latest round that was added and the potential for the December 15th increase in tariffs? Because the company has a profit margin of 6.07%, which is not really small like you'd see in certain companies like grocers or other retailers, but not that large. And that tariff could really take a big chunk out of their particular, their profit margin. Okay, so I got some of that information in. I went back to the charts. I looked at the weekly ranges. So on a weekly basis, when I looked at this chart from some of the things that we look at price and volume, an algorithm that we developed here, and we look at market profiles and a variety of other things to look on a weekly and a daily and a monthly and whether it's intraday. So there's this wide range of resistance and support from about $70.50 down to about $62. When I say wide range, it's not the widest I've ever seen. That's only about 12%, but right, about 12, it's about $8. Yeah, about 12%. But what was more interesting about this was that it was much wider, this range, than I've seen previously. Oh, and on a daily basis, there's something we call the hole. It's a fast zone. It's a fast zone to the upside. So if a stock breaks above 66, as I see it, it could be this really quick move or a squeeze, a short squeeze, to about 69, which is where I would consider that being some significant resistance. And we don't hold a position in this name, but I'd consider it. Even though the stock did much better and raised their guidance, I would look to keep this on a radar of some sort, keep this in a watch list, because the potential for the margin compression to hit and for short positions to reshort as short interest has come down recently is high. So even though we got this move above 66, I'm going to mark that as a potential opportunity to look at the upside of this stock up to about 69 and then consider a short entry at that point, or depending on the positioning, if it does in fact continue higher. I would look at this at that level, about 69 or so, because again, the fundamentals are okay, but retail's in a really precarious situation. If you look at the history of the stock, it's held up pretty well. But if in fact there is any kind of erosion of profitability due to the tariffs, and if in fact we do see the economy slowing a bit, people may be thinking, you know, I don't need to buy that luxury plate for $22 for a plate. I can buy the same thing somewhere else for $8. That's what happens. We've seen this across the board many times as economies slow down. The higher end wares obviously slow down over time as well. So even though some of their other areas of focus have done well of late, I think there was some easy comps historically over the last year or so to have them move up so well. We're going to do some more work on this, but just some insight there. And the point of all this was that when I combined my confirmation bias and stopped for a second and said, let me look at this, because if I were to go and just short this, which may end up being the right thing to do, I don't know, right now from where I sit at this moment, more work has to be done, but it may be the perfect place right now to short. And I could have been just lucky that I happened to walk in the store at that moment. But if I would stay with just what I thought by looking at this one store and the responses that I got from Twitter, with everybody agreeing to me with me saying, yeah, that place sucks, that place is expensive, and all the things that they said, I would have rushed into a short just on that without doing the research. You got to do all the research and find out all of the different particulars and then set a plan up. I talk about this all the time. You have to have a plan. Put your plan together, act on your plan, and then things will hopefully work out right. But just flippantly going out and now shorting this with the opportunity for this squeeze after looking at the short interest, after looking at where the chart is leading me, after looking at the analyst upgrades and the average, while it is a hold, still there's upside opportunity if they start increasing their rating. So I want to be careful not to get caught in that squeeze, because if I do, I may just get blown out of the stock when it starts moving above 66, if it does do that, and then never get the opportunity to really go and short if there is that opportunity that arises. Just a little bit of a combination and bringing together the two concepts of confirmation bias and then some research that you have to do and how to overcome some of that. So there is no answer on my Williams-Sonoma right now, but it is definitely on a list to watch for the short side, considering some of the things we know about retail, the resistance level on the chart, but yet at the same time, lower conviction level than I was when I walked into the empty store after I saw all the information. More to follow on this in the future. And we're going to end the show today with some listener questions. You can always get in touch with me. Lots of ways to do so, whether it's Twitter, whether it's over on the website. You go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I encourage you all to do this. Don't be scared. Don't be afraid. If you never did it before, it's easy. Seriously, I like your questions. I like your emails. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the Ask Andrew. It's on the right. It's on the top. Just ask away. And either if your question is appropriate to put on the show, I will do so. If you have a question about your portfolio or how we manage money, Investology, by the way, hot in terms of some of the comments I recently got with people really enjoying that. We have a client webinar coming up that's client only. If you want to get involved in that, well, you got to become a client. So go over to Investology. It's over on the Disciplined Investor as well. $10,000 minimum. If you want to get your feet wet and check out what we can do for you and how we manage money, it's a really, I think it's a really great program where it combines the idea of this, you know, robo-esque situation where we have technology enhanced and advisor-crafted portfolios that give you, in my opinion, the best of all worlds. We're managing the money, picking the investments for you, dependent on your risk tolerance and time horizon. It all comes together with what we're talking about. It's only $10,000. I know my listeners have that because we've done surveys before. And you asked for this. It's a way to start getting involved with working with us. On your way to the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy or our Global Allocations. But just a terrific way to get a feel for how we manage money. Now, this is a little bit more of a online version of it. But still, it will show you exactly what we're investing in, how we're investing, what we're doing, and understand more about how it is that we do what we do. So just to get back to this, you can go over to Ask Andrew, ask those questions, and I have one that comes in from Tim Barnes, and he says, hey, having been recently become a fan of your podcast, so please forgive these questions if it's covered before. And we'll get to the first one here. It says, knowing that you get what you pay for, what are your thoughts on free apps such as Stash or Robinhood for the casual investing? So casual investing, I first have the biggest problem with there, Tim. What is casual investing? Is that like gambling? Is that like kind of throw some money in, see what it does? Is there such a thing? I guess there is. If you're doing casual investing, I think you first have to ask yourself why you're doing it. Secondly, if you're just investing a few dollars, if it says maybe we'll change the terminology there and we'll say for the novice investor, for the first time, for the small investor, you know, it's an expensive proposition, even though it's free from everything that we see. But if it's a way for you to get involved in the beginning, to understand more about investing, to get you started because you just feel it's free and, well, what the hell, I'll put some money in ABC stock and I could do it at a very small level and it's no cost to do so on the outside. Of course, we know that there's other costs that are going on in terms of where you bought it, order flow that they're getting paid for, possible execution, poor execution. You know, there's a lot of potential issues going on there. But nonetheless, if it's getting you started and that's what's going to pull you in to the idea of investing, which creates wealth for you for the future and does all the things that you need it to do for your retirement, because this game, this whole idea of investing is the greatest wealth generator anywhere. That's the beauty of it. Some say, well, I like to take it slow when I want to make it grow over time. I'm not really willing to take a lot of risk. Okay, that's fine. Some people say, you know what? I'm going to play it hard. And I want to invest and I want to invest aggressively and hopefully reach the goals that I have by doing so. Whatever your style is, number one, get started. Number two, once you graduate from that and you want to use things like Stash or Robinhood, I really don't have a comment in terms of if you're a new person to investing and you're just starting out, but that is not your long-term plan. Your long-term plan is either to educate yourself in a way that is commensurate with understanding what's happening with markets and making good decisions based on understanding the fundamentals, technicals, and all sorts of another analysis, or teaming up with an advisor, working with somebody that can help you along to meet your goals, your objectives, that is commensurate with your level of risk and time horizon. I mean, that's kind of really the point there. So I hope that answers that question. Let's see what I have here. This question comes from Steve Otera. He says, there's $15 trillion of negative interest rate debt in the... Is that deflationary or inflationary? Why is the EU trying to buy this and what are they trying to accomplish? Are they doing lower currency or drive cash into productive investments, corporate bonds, for example? It is not good for the person purchasing this debt. What about existing debt? Does this become more valuable? Well, there is about 22 questions in there. We will get to the concept and I think what you're asking me. So yes, I think the $15 billion of debt is actually closer to $17 billion of debt. And is it deflationary or inflationary? The concept is it's inflationary concept. Has it been actually creating inflation? No. Are they lowering their currency and technically lowering their potential rating? Yes. What are they trying to accomplish? Well, they're trying to make sure there's a buyer for the bonds and fund the governments as best as possible, fund corporations across the region as well, making sure that there is an actual buyer of this schlock. Because really, who's going to be buying these bonds at these low levels? And they've actually pushed the level so low on purpose, hoping, yes, to put money into the street, to get money out of the banks and out of the system and push it into the hands of where it is much more productive, into the capital markets, into businesses, creation of businesses, lend money out for people to buy homes, thereby creating jobs in the construction area, etc. Is it working? Absolutely not. What would have been the case if they didn't do this is the big question. That's the one question. What if they didn't do this? How bad would things be? I offer this up. I think that actually they'd be possibly better off. I think the banking system would be a lot healthier. I think we wouldn't have this very significant bubble that is growing across the entire globe of negative and low interest rates, reliance on central banks to actually manage this whole process and to hope for they know what they're doing in this grand experiment of all experiments. So the new normal is going to be this modern monetary theory, MMT, which goes for the fact that we can have a much higher level of debt outstanding and it won't hurt anything. Whereas in years past, the idea was don't have debt. It's a drag on the economy. I think we all realize and recognize and can very easily see that the debt mounts that we have currently around the world are absolutely slowing down growth. But unfortunately, we also, I think many of us agree, there's really no way out of it right now. The only way out of this is exponential growth, which it is stymieing, so that can't happen. Or basically bringing down the value of your currency to a point where you're much more competitive and hopefully extinguish the debt in that manner over time. So there you go. This question comes from Alan Schoen. And he writes and he says, the markets are getting shaky. They were up and down a lot this week. At the end of the day and end of the week, stocks were up. And I get the wondering whether the Fed has anything to do with that. In my limited understanding, the Fed's quickest way to influence the market is by buying and selling bonds on the open market. My question is first, whether it's really the most likely way the Fed would go to prop up stocks. Yep, that's what he says. Likely way to go to prop up stocks. And second, whether there is any way to tell whether that's happening. I mean, I think we know that's happening. They're buying bonds. There's no question. The question people are really asking, my friend, is are they buying stocks too? Right? There is data. We know that there is data on the direct purchases of the bonds that come out during the week, the treasuries that come out. You can look at the direct and indirect purchases and breaks down who's buying what, as well as look at the historic balance sheet levels by the Fed. So we know that they are continuing with some quantitative easing programs to a degree, letting some things roll off. You don't know exactly what's happening, but you go over to like Fred, F-R-E-D, look up Fred data, Fred economic data, and you could find that there is information about the balance sheet holdings that will give you an update and you can see the trend and where it's going. So yes, the Fed is buying, is possibly involved in the markets to a degree, but lesser than they were historically, of course. The question you ask is one that maybe some of this we'll never know, but the other question you have to ask is also this. Who else? What other feds? What other organizations? What other sovereign wealth funds are monetizing debt, utilizing that to buy stocks in the U.S. or other markets around the world, or bonds? We know it's happening. We know it's happening. So something to look at. We're going to end it right there. Thanks for your questions. Answered a few more by email this week as well. If you want to get in touch with me, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You want us to look at managing your money, review your portfolio. It's a good time back to school. Let's review your portfolio. Send me an email. Send me an Ask Andrew. Go over there and just say, hey, I want you to review my portfolio. Tell me what's going on. There's no charge. We'll just see what's going on, get an idea of what's happening. Maybe there's something that can be done to get you in line with where you should be, or maybe it's just right the way it is. Either way, just a second opinion. So let us check it out for you. Look under the hood. Make sure everything is going well. Kind of a portfolio checkup. Good time to do so. I would like to do that for you. Give me that opportunity. Let's see if we can help you make sure you're on the right track. We're going to see you next week. I want to thank you so much for being here. Until then, have a profitable week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.